Well, I'm Bob Osborne, and I thank you for sharing this time with me. One of the things that strikes me about this conference, especially on this topic or these topics that we're dealing with, is that Labrie is one of the very few communities that you can find anywhere where people can come together and really wrestle with these issues without fighting or without being at each other's throat or without canceling each other. Do you feel that way as I do? I mean, it's just so evident that this is a refreshing context of grace and yet deep exploration. To bring those two together is very rare. I mean, I promise you, I have a strong background in academia, as do some of the speakers here, and it is not pleasant in academia right now. It's not, is it? It's just tough. So thank you. And I look forward to you interacting today. And as I'll say it now, your pushback, whenever you'd like to offer it, and if you want to offer it, is welcome. Because I learn from others. And that has always been my posture. And I hold that for a good philosophical as well as theological reasons. Well, let's pray together. Shall we do that? Our Father, we thank you that this is a rich context, but it's also a glorious context where the unity of the body of Christ is displayed in a way that is so desperately needed in so many settings today. Even pastors, as I just talked in the last few minutes, are struggling. They're burnt out, Father, from the wars, the internal wars, the struggle with COVID, and everything else. So, Lord, help us now as we together seek to understand how we can best serve our less privileged neighbors and how to respond to the social justice movement that in many ways is causing, it seems, significant harm to much of our society. We pray this now in your name. Amen. Well, thank you once again. So let's begin by looking together at what our planning is today. We want to explore together some of the challenges behind this kind of a talk. There are challenges, and if we understand some of those challenges, we're going to be much more effective in being able to communicate with one another and understanding each other. Definitions, always very helpful. We're going to spend some time on U.S. racial history because while the social justice movement is more than just about race, currently the main register for it is a racial register. So we're going to focus on U.S. racial history, then do it in an all-important worldview analysis of the social justice movement. And why would a worldview analysis be so important? Anybody want to offer a response? Why is a worldview analysis so important? Yes?
We live what we believe.
That's exactly right. So it's not just that we have these realities of belief out here and our life is out here, but they're somehow connected and they tend to work both ways, we actually know. Any other comments in terms of why we would be talking about a worldview analysis in a Labrie conference?
Because
we're part of the world, yes. And when we talk about worldview, to be more specific, we're using a term that a German philosopher developed, but it's one that Francis Schaeffer himself actually popularized back in the 60s. And so Christians virtually, no American Christians even had heard the term until Schaeffer brought it in and introduced it in the mid to late 60s. And that has permanently changed for the better the American conversation. But in any case, we'll then look what I think are some serious problems created by this movement and then talk about how we can be redemptive change agents. There are ways to really serve our less privileged neighbors, but let's talk about the Schaeffers themselves. Edith, I only knew Edith and met Francis only once in the summer of 1972, very briefly. But I think this statement, which was written last year by Christopher Talbot, is one well worth reading together. So I'm going to read it. You can listen. Relatively unique within his more fundamentalist context, Schaeffer engaged in a level of racial reconciliation that was rooted in his theological anthropology. His wife, Edith, records that during segregation, Schaeffer consistently sought to meet and to fellowship with African Americans. Likewise, Schaeffer continually met with an older African American man who had worked as a janitor at the Schaeffer's College. Now, I'm not quite sure which college, but I think it's Covenant College in Lookout Mountain, Georgia, but I'm not sure exactly what school this man's referring to. Anyway, Schaeffer would visit him up until his death, reading the Bible and praying with him. Similarly, Bars, referring to Jerome Bars, who was on the faculty at Covenant Seminary, observed how the Schaeffers welcomed people of all races into their home at Labrie, and how Schaeffer performed marriages for interracial couples, even to the dismay of his critics. In his writings, he points out the atrocities of the slave trade and the need for social action that is grounded in the basis of Christian faith and willing to stand against social injustices. You may, if you were listening to the last lecture, Doug Greuthuis was referring to, at one point, Born Black by Sylvester Jacobs. And has anybody ever seen a portrait of a shelter? Wonderful. None of you have seen this. Oh, you've seen it. Wonderful. It's a full-sized photo book, the kind you put on a coffee table. It was published in 1972 by InterVarsity Press. And it's nothing but photos of Labrie, and the people were going through Labrie in the early 70s. All of them were from Sylvester Jacobs, a black man, who incidentally was at this conference just a few years ago taking photos. And I've often wondered if he was ever going to do some sort of a follow-up photo book. It would have been a wonderful thing, but I never saw that come to light. Well, let's talk about some of the interconnected challenges that are facing us and our churches. I think it's without a question that at least since the 60s, this is the toughest time. But we also have to look back to the 60s for a sexual revolution. And you're going to see, especially in the latter part of my presentation, why I think those two realities, especially today, are closely tied together. I'll skip number three, but number four, we often embrace worldviews for a reason that a moral psychologist at NYU noted in what I think is a tremendous book. I don't agree with everything he says in the book, but I think his fundamental insight in the righteous mind is that essentially what is happening when people make decisions about life and they make their major worldview commitments, as I did in November of 1969 as a freshman at the University of Michigan. I had come to the university at a time when it was a very violent place. Every day there was a bombing or a demonstration, or we were being forced out of our exams because somebody was going to blow the building up while we were taking exams. Or, you know, it was just chaos. And in the midst of that, of course, being a new student, I was very homesick. So having heard about Christ in the last couple years of high school from a man that I had worked for, I was invited then by a classmate in November of 69, to a Baptist church, by the way. And I was invited to this Baptist church in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And when I heard the gospel, clearly the Spirit of God was working in me. But at that moment, when I responded and said yes, what I was doing was not responding because I had thought through all of the apologetic arguments for Christianity and concluded they were true. Yes, I was a pretty smart guy, as people go, but I hadn't done that kind of work. I had made an largely emotional decision first. And then, as what Haidt points out, after people make their major commitments, then they go seeking rational reasons for why they have adopted the position that they have adopted. And indeed, that's exactly what happened to me, because one night in January of 1970, 2 months later, would you believe it, there were some Assembly of God missionaries who were going through campus. That was when dorms were wide open. They came to North Campus. I was in Bursley Hall, knocking on doors. Would you like this book, Escape from Reason? I took it. I had no idea who Francis Schaeffer was. But when I heard one of the more hostile guys on our dorm floor shout, "It's Christian, burn it," you know what I did? I said, "Wow, this has got to be good." And of course, by the grace of God, I was welcomed into a wonderful life, and understood really what it meant to have good reasons to be a follower of Christ. But to move on, number five, we have the reality of postmodern worldview and how this has begun to shape and affect our churches, and then the claim that white supremacy is very systemic in our society. So I'm now going to show you a slide with Ibram Kendi. How many of you have heard of Kendi? Okay, so many of you are tracking with this phenomenon, his key book, How to Be an Anti-Racist. How many have read the book? Okay, you've read it. Okay, so you may remember how he begins the book. He begins the book with an event where I was a student attendee. Well, would you believe it? He begins the book talking about InterVarsity's Urbana Conference 1970, where Tom Skinner was telling us that Christ is the liberator. I remember it very clearly. I had just become a Christian a year earlier. It was thrilling to be there, and it was a life-changing event for me. The reason he starts it out there is he wants us to know that his parents were at the conference also. They were there as college students, not married, and they were sincere followers of Christ. Later on, he tells us then, they became married, and then they adopted the radical black theology of James Cone. Now, James Cone, interestingly enough, was writing his major work of radical black theology when he was a professor at Adrian College, which was only 5 miles from the farm where I was growing up in southeast Michigan. But his parents adopted this radical theology, which really began to shape the trajectory for Ibram Kendi, who declares absolutely without equivocation that white supremacy is systemic. It cannot be erased from anyone who identifies as white. But one of the other people who is mirroring that message is Robin DiAngelo, who has recently become affiliated with the University of Washington in her very famous book, White Fragility. Essentially, the same kind of message. So these are all challenges that are confronting us as we deal with this. But what I would like to suggest finally is that number seven, it is the view increasingly of many thinkers in our society that Christianity is itself a moral threat. Now this is in all respects unimaginable for someone of my age. It's unimaginable to think of Christianity in those terms, but that is the new way of perceiving Christianity, so that if you are not buying into the current de rigueur ideas and social justice and sexuality and gender theory, as Doug Greuthuis was talking about, you, my brothers and sisters, are a threat. You may be very immoral, in fact, according to that way of seeing reality. So when we deal with this issue, we're not dealing with something that's very, very simple that we can sort of just easily go through. you wouldn't be at a Libri conference anyway if you didn't realize that the challenges are significant. Okay? Yes, sir.
Just a quick clarification.
Indeed.
On number 7 there, perception that Christian faith is a threat. Well, crazy people with weapons are threats, as are prophets. The one is positive, the other negative.
So, well put.
How would I understand that sentence more precisely?
Yeah. It is to understand the fact that Christianity is countercultural. 50, 60 years ago, the hippie movement would have been perceived as countercultural, right? Those who eventually then others who led the sexual revolution, that was seen as countercultural. And it literally at that time what happened was a pre-existing Christian moral consensus in this society was thrown off in a very rapid and aggressive fashion. We today are now countercultural. We are not acting in flow with what the corporations, the academic leaders, the media leaders, the pop culture leaders, all of them are saying, get on board, get on the right side of history. That's what I mean by that. We're not on the right side of history. Yes.
And I think consequently, if I'm understanding
you. Yes, indeed.
Consequently, CRT and social justice is diametrically opposed to Christian faith, even though it masquerades and finds its way in by
right.
seemingly caring
yes.
for people.
Yes, yes. Thank you for, you stated it very well. I'm going to argue that, in fact, CRT, Christian critical race theory, is actually clearly opposed to Christian faith on worldview grounds. And that's why we're going to spend some time looking at it in those kinds of terms. Exactly. So let's make sure we know our terms, our terminology, and we're just literally going to have to walk through this and talk through this, okay? So what is critical theory? This is a variant of Marxism that was actually first developed at the Frankfurt School in Germany in the 30s. It studies texts and human society, and it works with the assumption that society is divided between oppressors and the oppressed. This is the great insight of the critical theorist. So critical race theory, developed by Derrick Bell, a black legal scholar, several decades ago, assumes that there is a system of white supremacy that ensures that blacks and other minorities are being literally systemically oppressed on the basis of their racial and ethnic identities. But again, it works with this oppressor-oppressed model. White supremacy is the effort to organize American life around the interests of black people and around the interests of white people and against the interests of those who are blacks. Social justice. Now, the way I'm going to use the terms social justice and ideological social justice interchangeably. My friend Scott Allen, who has, I think, one of the best, maybe the best book in this field, and who does the best job with worldview analysis, he uses the ideological social justice. But it's a movement that seeks, you know, human liberation. And so, yeah, it sounds really good. If you're not using a thinking hat and if you are not grounded in a Christian worldview, that's why this is seeping into our churches very rapidly. Intersectionality, which is a more complicated term that you've been hearing, is if you belong to more than one oppressed group, then you will experience magnified injustice at the intersection of those oppressed identities, gender, sexual orientation, race, ethnicity, and religion. So, and what that also means, if you have magnified injustice, you're also, in essence, more holy or more righteous. You have an inherited kind of innocence, whereas the white supremacist is a party to evil that needs to be somehow cleansed. I remember about 12 years ago at the University of Minnesota, I had recently earned my PhD later in life in education at the university. So the university was looking for, it so happened around 12, maybe 14 years ago, I should probably say. looking for a new dean of the College of Education, Human Development. This tremendous woman came from Columbia University, the top teachers' school in the country. And here, she was a woman. She was black. She was a lesbian, and she was a Buddhist. I mean, if she had been disabled, that would have been the only thing that would have made her the absolute quadrifecta, or quintifecta, or whatever it is. But she definitely got a quadrifecta out of that. I know that for sure. And it was literally to be in that interview, that public interview with her, it was to be in the presence of a messianic figure. In 2 years, she put the college in $9 million in debt. They had to get her out of there as fast as they could because she was going to permanently destroy the college. They wouldn't actually have money to sustain that college. So anyway, that's a story. That doesn't mean that everybody operates like that. That's a story. Liberation theology is a neo-Marxist movement that began largely with left-wing Catholic priests in Latin America in the 1950s and 1960s. Paulo Freire's Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Anybody recognize the book? The thing. This is on almost all academic educators' libraries. Pedagogy of the Oppressed. Anybody recognize this? Okay, Paulo Freire was a left-wing Catholic priest who was working out. He helped develop liberation theology, working right out of critical theory. And so the gospel is reinterpreted in terms of Christ overthrowing oppressors. And finally, that current word woke, those who simply had a consciousness-raising experience suddenly realizing, oh, I have all along been an oppressor. Or, if I'm from one of the favored groups, I realize now I've been oppressed. My eyes are now open. That's the idea of woke. Okay? So, this is a tough one. The next few slides are tough because while I disagree dramatically with the movement, I don't want to in any way minimize the tragedy of American racial history. It is a tragedy that 4 million black slaves were owned. They were the property of others in America at the beginning of the Civil War, which cost 700,000 lives to ultimately end slavery. And then there was this horrible phenomenon that lasted for 90 years. 4,000 black lynchings and all kinds of other incredible injustices and tragedies that were driven by white racism. So we do not, and I do not deny that this was psychologically demeaning, but I dramatically reject what Jamar Tisby, who is a black reformed historian and theologian, does in his book, Color of Compromise. Because in that book, as he is relating and telling the story of this phenomenon, he never distinguishes between what was historically and what is today. Now, I was just listening in the last week or two to Glenn Lowry, a black economist at Brown University, who was very critical of this kind of movement by people like Tisby, who allied together the past and the present because they believe that white supremacy is systemic and that it cannot ultimately be erased. So that's the assumption. And I say that not to diminish the horror of the black experience before the Martin Luther King civil rights movement. So now let's talk about the black experience in the USA. I first of all declare right up front, there is real racism that's still occurring in America. There is still this also religious bigotry, isn't there? Anybody surprised about that? But racism is a much more sensitive topic. And so it takes very little to ignite deep feelings on this issue. My black friends who are wonderful black pro-life leaders who are trying to spread the word about what they call, and I think they're right, the black genocide of today. They were searching several years ago for a home in a far north suburb of, north of the Twin Cities. It was pretty bad. So there is the sense of feeling different and sometimes misunderstood, feeling marginalized. I don't write that off as the experience of some people who are identify as black or African American. And some would say that being around white people all the time can actually be kind of exhausting. Well, you know, just ask my wife what it's like to be around me sometimes. You know, she probably, I know she says, I can only take him so much of the time. So I understand that idea that because of some kind of difference, it can be a little bit exhausting. I admit that when I was in Africa several months ago for 2 weeks, I was glad that I wouldn't have to be there for a long period of time because I would have to spend endless hours in long worship services where people dance a lot. And I don't have the dancing. I don't have the dancing gene. It's just not in me. I don't feel beat in me, you know. And you got to feel beat in order to. And I can promise you, my African godly African friends, they'll hear a drum in the distance. I've literally seen this in Ghana, and the body will start moving just like this, just in time with the drum. So, you know, it's a wonderful expression that I can't share in, and I would be exhausted. Black families, though, this is part of what hurts, and this is where I'm going, you'll see, this ties into where we're going for much of the rest of the time. The black abortion rate, I wish my friends were here because they would plead with tears in their eyes for you to realize the horror of abortion at 5, maybe 6 times higher than for white women. And according to them, this leaves real scars that are endemic in these relatively small African-American community of 13 or 14% of American population. Thus, 75%, roughly 75% of black children are born to single mothers. Now that is an incalculably tragic figure. That means there is a critical mass that has been reached, what I would call a critical mass of systemic dysfunction at the family level in the black community. And in fact, there are many studies that confirm this. And as you'll see, I'll have a slide later called Convergent Disparities. This is a term I've developed. But I point and argue that the question of family formation has almost everything to do with outcomes in life. And I would furthermore be willing to say, suggest, though I don't want to claim with absolute authority, but I'm willing to suggest that the tremendous disparities in black experience in America significantly are due to the problem of black family fragmentation. And we can get into this as much as you want to during the Q&A, but that also involves tremendous amount of violence. So it is very common to know black people who have a relative that's been shot or killed, not by white people, almost always by another black person. You can imagine how life as a black person in America, especially if you're from a fragmented family, can be very traumatic. But the other reality today is there is a culture of victimhood that's being blown up into hugely. And I suggest, and I'm not alone, there are black scholars who are talking about this right now, this is very psychologically debilitating. And I despise it. And I think it's hurting the black community, in particular, very seriously. But before I go on and talk about some other issues related to it, I want to share this 2021, very late, just a couple months ago, a letter from a very close, highly educated black friend of mine. And I'm sharing this with you because I want you to know that I don't think this is an easy topic. And I don't come to the conclusions I do lightly. But this is what he writes. And it's uncomfortable for me to even read this, because I know him very well. He's a very close friend. My wife has worked in predominantly white contexts dominated by white males. She has shared how she felt, or she shared the truth, namely, that's implicit, that twice she has been unjustly terminated. Yours truly has worked in two previous contexts dominated by white evangelical Christian men. In both instances, I was unjustly let go. My current Christian employer is run by close friends who are white evangelical Christian males. Bob, I and my wife have been burned twice. Why should I risk another unpleasant departure? He's saying, why should I risk leaving this third Christian employer? It's just going to be miserable, he says. If full orb diversity was truly a value of this company, I would not have been the only African-American male for the last, and I don't tell you how many years because I don't want to give that away. The length of time this place has been opened, he says. Bob, many white evangelical Christians smile on my face and have a knife ready to stab me in the back. That was probably the hardest part of this letter for my friend. Because I know I don't have a knife ready to stab him in the back. I'd do anything for this brother. But there's the issue of perception and subjectivity. We'll talk about it in a minute. I'm tired of people who read the same Bible, enabled by the same Holy Spirit, and treat me as though I am not made in God's image. You have never been an educated black person in white male-dominated spaces, so I don't expect you to understand. In the earlier session, this was really tough, and I think it's tough for most of us to read this. I think the person said, you know, is this perception or is this reality? This is largely perception, I would argue. But perception is a very big part of how we live our lives. I don't just go through life, you know, having some sort of standard that my wife matches objectively and I agree to love you because you objectively, you know, meet the... No, that wouldn't be love, would it? There has to be the perception on my part that I love her and that she knows and perceives that I love her. So there's a huge part of this is perception, but there is some objective reality buried in this. And this is tough. It's really tough. Yes, sir.
I think this goes beyond perception.
Please add to that.
It's an experience. That's yeah. What somebody has experienced. Perception is something that you observe or that you conclude. An experience is something that you actually go through yourself, and this is a very personal experience. So this, to me, is way stronger than a perception.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I might not make that same distinction, but I appreciate you pointing out that you see this as an experience. And so let me pick up on your point, because one of the arguments made by the people who are strong advocates for critical race theory and for the social justice movement is to say that they use something called standpoint theory, which is something James Lindsay in his book on critical race theory talks about. Standpoint theory says, if in your standpoint, in your experience, your standpoint, you experience something, then that has greater epistemic value. Epistemic means greater knowledge value than somebody who is a social scientist telling you what the social science tells you. And you'll see this regularly. When somebody who maybe is a black person in an audience like this who may stand up and say, you know, this is my experience, like I'm providing here. And we all get naturally very quiet. And most of us, I think, feel very humble. Sometimes I feel humiliated as a white person. And I, you know, what would I do now? You know, how do I respond? And I'm, I think, articulating what maybe some of you are feeling and thinking now. Yes, sir.
The words are probably going to come out somewhat skewed, but
okay.
I can fully empathize with those people because that's happened to me as
well.
And I don't have the advantage to couch it in racial terms.
But you had the same, roughly the same experience.
I can tell you horror stories of working in churches. Wow. And it's ugly.
Oh, yeah, that's
and,
just
wow.
And so I can fully empathize with that.
Exactly.
And you know, it's interesting.
But the race has nothing to do with it, you're saying.
Race basically has nothing to do with it. And the interesting challenge is at work, when I worked.
Yeah.
There was a guy that I worked with who worked for a Christian company, the Christian CEO, who was a very Christian donator to a lot of Christian ministries.
Right.
In his desk, he had a big desk in his office, had people in. Behind him is a big picture of Jesus, and he, under this picture of Jesus, slit people's throats, figuratively.
Figuratively.
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot under the covers in Christian churches of all flavors. And I think we don't appreciate how destitute we are in spite of our nice clothes and fancy smells.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's real.
Yeah. I appreciate you bringing that out. And that's what a social scientist would say, thank you, because that's the kind of data. That's only anecdotal data, by the way, so it has limited social scientific value. But it's the kind of data that says, okay, maybe we need to ask a few more questions. Is it possible, from a social scientific standpoint, that the real problem is there is a dysfunctional Christian organizational culture that may be interpreted in racial terms if you're black, but you had it as a white man, the same really bitter experience from a Christian employer who has no problem destroying your life.
And you don't say it too much, because then people will interpret it, well, if it happened to you multiple times, you're the idiot.
Right.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's your fault then.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's another one of the painful parts of this kind of thing, isn't it? Thank you for sharing that. I think that's very apropos and needed. Thank you. Let me just say, some of you have seen this evidence, some of you have not, but there's a lot of evidence that people like Roland Fryer, who's a black social scientist at Harvard University, has collected on the issues of race, crime, and policing in the United States. He and some others, but he's the main one, Roland Fryer. It is true that most blacks perceive police stops as threatening, but in reality, when you look at fatal police shooting victims, though blacks are known to be 53% of homicide offenders, only 23% are actually killed by police. In other words, what we should expect based on this larger statistic is that 50% of black homicide offenders would potentially be shooting victims, or at least a greater, let me just simply, that's not quite right, you didn't state that quite right, but a higher percentage of fatal police shooting victims should be black based on the on that evidence. And when it comes to the homicides of black men, about 10,000 a year, now it's probably higher because this was 2019 data, I think, but only 223 are at the hands of police. And essentially, what the research also shows is that a black man is 18 times more likely to be killed by a black male. The police themselves are 18 times more likely to be killed by a black male than to kill an unarmed black male. And we saw an example of that just a few nights ago in one of our major cities where this happened. So though the hard thing here is that the rate of criminality is much, much higher in the black population than it should be if it was simply all proportional. And that's something that really adds, I think, clearly, without a question, to the trauma in the black community. But now I'd like to switch the focus, and now I want us to do the worldview analysis that I promised. Now, a worldview, very simply, is a big story about reality based on deep assumptions that tells us how to live and what to worship. Now, I teach an online course every fall called Comparative Worldviews. So this is a definition I've honed literally over the last 13 years of teaching that course. But let's utilize the work of Scott Allen, his book, Why Social Justice is Not Biblical Justice. The reason I think this is the finest book on this topic is because he uses, as part of his text, a worldview analysis. And what I'm suggesting is that if we use that kind of analysis, then it can clarify our thinking and help us to understand that what's going on with the social justice movement is really anti-gospel. So let's understand how this. There are going to be three slides that look like this, okay? On the left-hand column, you have questions. There are 9 basic questions that every worldview asks and answers. By the way, I understand that other teachers use fewer questions. I sort of maximize. So the first one that's asked by all worldviews is, what is ultimate? So the social justice movement is really trying to say that power is what's ultimate in our experience, and that's what really matters. Whereas, of course, biblically, the infinite personal God is central. So what is the next line, the next row? What is the everyday world? There, it's, according to the social justice people, something that we and our friends decide to make it. It's something we create through human effort. Whereas, biblically, we understand ourselves as joyful stewards who are protecting and produce and being productive in God's world. Very, very different understanding of the everyday world. So what does it mean to be human? Well, a big theme in this conference, as you're hearing, is that humans are autonomous. This is something that Carl Truman, whose book you're going to constantly be hearing about, The Rise and Triumph of the Modern Self, it really is one of the finest works of intellectual history that I have ever read, and I highly recommend it. You're going to hear this term, autonomous beings. Schaefer himself in the 50s and 60s was using this language. We're autonomous. That is, we're separated. We have no obligations. We operate according to our own individual timetables. We are either oppressed or we're oppressors. Whereas Christianity understands us as image bearers, okay? So I'm just asking you to follow through the worldview analysis. Again, now we come to question number 4 up in the upper left-hand corner. How do we know? It's the question of knowledge or epistemology, which I alluded to earlier. So social justice movement says, since the idea of truth itself is very oppressive, by the way, this idea of the oppressive nature of truth comes right out of the heart of postmodernism. This is Foucault. If some of you have heard of Foucault, major French theorist. This was his big theme, truth oppresses. And so the subjective experience issue, then that becomes the critical way of knowing. The standpoint theory enters at this point. Biblically, we understand that while we can use reason and research to know, because we have to pursue what's true, we really need also as part of our objective truth, divine revelation in the scripture. So the next question, the next row, what is history? So the social justice focus folks tell us there is no master story. We just know that there are micro narratives of oppression. That's all of history. And so Howard Zinn's book, A People's History of the United States, which is widely assigned in high school and college classrooms on U.S. history, makes that exact working assumption. I feel that is a very devastating text, and it's devastated hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. Biblically, we understand that history is shaped by human choice, but ultimately directed by God to a just outcome. So then the bottom row, what happens at death? Well, the best that the social justice folks, working out of their worldview, which is essentially postmodern, so when you're looking at social justice, think postmodern worldview, the best they can say is that some of those who die are like George Floyd, martyrs for their cause. And then finally, again, working through this worldview analysis, what is the fundamental problem? This is very important to ask. Well, by now it's obvious, isn't it? It's all about oppression. That is the fundamental problem. And it's people who look just like me, who function just like me, and a number of others in this room who are the central problem, because we are the oppressors. So I work with foreign students who come to study in the United States. That's my job. And so I'm regularly explaining to them, if they're new here, that in the eyes of their humanities and social science faculty at the University of Minnesota and other schools, they are going to be taught that essentially people who look like me are the central problem in all of human history. Now, biblically, of course, we understand that the problem is rebellion leading to sin. The solution, of course, is that you have to have a revolution where may not be all super violent, but you've got to have the oppressed unmasking, deconstructing, and overthrowing oppressive structures, systems, and institutions till there are no disparities. No disparities. This whole quest, and I promise you it's a utopian quest that we're on right now as a society, there is no way that this will ever end, because there will be no way to end the disparities. I promise you. Under the current assumptions, the secular assumptions, the postmodern assumptions that we have, the biblical solution is God providing himself as a substitute for our sin. How should we live? Well, there you go. You must defend the oppressed. So to understand the phenomenon of seeing largely white-led crowds and masses of people with a few black people in the crowd who are objecting to and chanting, you know, no peace, no justice over the latest death of some black person who's had an encounter with a policeman. And I'm not defending all those encounters. I'm not all of them. But the reason for that is essentially this is about defending the oppressed. So they've been taught this in our colleges and universities. So you have to show up to do that. You have to put a Black Lives Matter sign in your yard, and it helps if you can add in love is love, and you know all colors are equal, and you know it doesn't matter who your parents are, et cetera, et cetera. So you have to ask yourself this. After having done this kind of worldview analysis, you really have to then ask yourself some key questions. This is the kind of thing that I'd like to encourage you to think about doing with those friends, neighbors, relatives, church members that are wrestling with these issues. None of us, I hope, in this room wants to cancel people. I am not interested in canceling anybody, even my worst enemy. It's just not in me. I still want to love them because Jesus said to love my enemies. I still want to engage them because I hope that I can persuade them. But what we should be asking them and ourselves is which worldview between those two makes better sense of reality. Now, this is what Schaeffer was all about. He was always trying to get people at Labrie to ask that question. What makes the best sense of reality? If you don't ask that question, you're never gonna get yourself out of this bind. And then secondly, we should also ask which worldview is more internally consistent, because internal consistency is one marker of a very good worldview. Next, which worldview, when examined over long times and spaces, leads to better outcomes for individual lives and societies? And why would you say this? That's a very important one, and one that I think the evidence is quite clear on right now. In fact, I think it's quite clear in all of them, but that one should stand out very easily. Number four, if the first three questions haven't helped, then I would challenge you to talk with your friends about the problem of bad diagnoses and bad prescriptions. I always tell this illustration, so it's very easy. You'll get it right away. I start coughing. The first thing you'll do is put on your mask if I start coughing up here, because you do not want to get COVID, do you? And you're going to probably tell me, hey, I've got a COVID test in my car and you can take it here. But maybe it gets worse and I really need a doctor to help me furthermore understand what's going on with me. Maybe this is something getting to be pneumonia. And a COVID test doesn't test for pneumonia. So I go in, I'm wheezing, I'm just dragging, I don't feel good. And the doctor says to me, well, I can tell what your problem is right now. You have a broken arm. And so we're going to fix it. We're going to put a cast on your arm. You'll be much better. Now, will you leave that office? Will I leave that office in better shape or worse shape? All I'm trying to do with this very simple illustration is to tell you this is exactly what happens with worldviews. Every worldview, and when I teach my comparative worldviews course, I have 12 major worldviews. We spend 1 week on each worldview, one class, I should say. We meet once a week. Now it's twice a week, I'm sorry. So one class on each of the 12 worldviews. The question is, does it get the diagnosis right? It has to get it right in order to give you the right prescription. And I'm suggesting this, the social justice movement completely and utterly fails. So this is the question then. If the truth sets people free, and I'm sure we would all agree with that, why are many of us afraid to speak the truth, but instead are willing to syncretize our faith or advocate for a worldview that contradicts our faith? By syncretization, I mean blending together the postmodern social justice worldview with Christian faith. I don't want to talk about problems with Black Lives Matter because we really don't have time, and I want to give you time enough to ask your questions. But let me briefly tell you that this is having a real impact in academia, in the church, and in American society. First of all, I'm just going to highlight the first point, and if anybody wants to come back to these, we'll talk more about them. But I want to give enough time for your questions. What is happening in academia today is that the purpose of higher education is morphing from the discovery and production of knowledge to the development of social activists. It's particularly concentrated in our colleges of education, but it's slowly spreading throughout our higher education institutions. This is very dangerous, folks. This is very dangerous. I ponder that, and I'll be glad to talk more about the issues in academia if you'd like. In the church, The social justice movement is becoming a religion, and by the way, it's becoming a religion inside and outside the church. But my concern is that many naive Christians are welcoming this, not realizing they're welcoming a contrary worldview that is anti-gospel. Now, I recommend Joshua Mitchell's American Awakening. American Awakening. This is a great book. What Joshua, he's a professor of political science at Georgetown University. What he argues in the book, and others are saying the same thing, but he's, I think, put it the best in my opinion, is that what's happening in our secular society, having abandoned a Christian consensus, with every successive generation having less access to Christian institutions, what's happening is fewer Americans are having access to the true gospel. And what does that gospel say? That by the grace of God alone, Christ has taken our place on the cross and he's died in our place to give us his righteousness. And when he gives us his righteousness, we are thoroughly justified. That's called salvation by grace through faith alone. And Ephesians 2:8-9 says the opposite is work salvation. And Mitchell says what's happening with the social justice movement is works salvation. And so you put signs up, you march, you do what our neighbor across the street did when they sent out their Christmas letter. Their wonderful daughter, who's a student at University of Minnesota Duluth, she's a wonderful young woman. They spent most of the letter bragging about the fact that she's getting anti-racist education training so she can be an anti-racist educator. That's called works salvation. And Mitchell's trying to tell us that Americans are desperate for this. And in one sense, it's a plea to the church to turn around and bring the gospel of grace through faith in Christ alone to our neighbors and our relatives. And then finally, number three, in American society, there is a triumph of subjectivity, valorization of victimhood, hyper-racialization, and white guilt. Peter Wood at the National Association of Scholars, he wrote this, I think this is so great. Some of you may have read Trollope's work from the 19th century. But this quote is, I think, brilliant. Trollope teaches us that man can be hanged by a rope woven out of strands of his own self-respect, provided the hangman has figured out how to make him feel guilty. And that's exactly what's happening in American society today. The hangman, the social justice movement, it's teaching most of us in this room how to feel guilty. So my response then is to suggest that the place we go as redemptive change agents is to talk about families. And let me tell you right now, I'm going to be very, if some of you are from Minnesota, we have one gubernatorial candidate in Minnesota who's building his campaign in part around this very issue. And that's why I'm actually supporting him. That's why I'm a delegate to the next convention, because I think anybody who's willing to focus on that issue understands exactly what needs to happen. The point here, in convergent disparities, I argue, and social scientists would agree with me, most who are honest and are not afraid of the social justice movement would agree that your family status and condition, the middle blue box, is the central variable that determines the levels of criminality in your life, your poverty levels, your educational achievement, your economic achievement, your future family status and health, your levels of happiness, and the probabilities that you'll be abused. All of those factors have been studied, and they correlate perfectly. There are always exceptions. There are always exceptions, but When you look at masses of people, which is how social scientists do it, it's very clear. So, we could talk about this. What this chart is showing us is that essentially median household income is highest when you have the lowest percentage of single-parent families. Asians have by far the lowest percentage in American society. Look at their high level of income. And look at the largest percentage, 70% in black communities, lowest. In fact, the correlation is inverse, and it's almost exactly and perfectly inverse. This is one of the key statements I want to leave you with, and I'll quickly wrap this up in the next minute. The deadly sexual revolution of the 60s, I lived in this, some of you lived in it with me, is, I believe, one of the greatest and most tragic things that ever happened to black people in the history of this country, other than slavery. College-educated whites with luxury beliefs, that's a new term that's been developed, protect themselves from the negative consequences of a sexual revolution they created, ignoring its devastating impact on less educated poor people who cannot similarly protect themselves. That's the argument of Myron Magnett's book from 1994, The Dream and the Nightmare. But this clearly seems to me to be the central issue, and we can talk about how that played out if you want. So I'm saying the solution is for gospel healing of black and other families. And so we need to teach, we need to come with truth and grace and a clear understanding of the Christian worldview. We should not apologize for it. Instead of talking about white privilege, we should talk about two-parent privilege and the success strategy, which is you finish high school, you get a job, you marry, then you have children in that order. Our educators are uniformly in our secular schools afraid to teach this. They will not teach this because they're afraid of offending people. What are they doing in education in America? And then finally, number three, I think we need to be energetically talking with our elected representatives about policy that will restrain family fragmentation and foster family health. That will mean, in many cases, investing a lot of money. I agree. We ought to spend it because it's one of the greatest and best investments we can ever make in human lives. I do not want to see the black community suffer the way they're suffering. And I don't think most of you do either. Okay, I'll be glad to take your questions. We can talk about other slides that I have here lots of things that we can discuss, but I'll be glad to take your questions.